Welcome to the World of Trouble with me, Sam Kiley, and Field Marshal Lord David Richards. That's quite a stack of titles. We've known each other a long time, and you have been in a world of trouble.
Probably true, Sam, but not in your league.
Field Marshal, the Lord Richards of Hurst-Monceau, a long journey or a meteoric journey from when we met in, I think it was 1999, originally in Freetown. Can you describe to me why it was in the first place that you ended up in the army?
Well, a lack of imagination, probably. By the way, I think everyone thought we were the same age because you were bald even then, Sam. And I had hair, wasn't grey. But yeah, happy memories, which I'm sure we'll come back to, of meeting. You were the only representative of the media still in Freetown in 1999 when things were looking extremely bleak. I thought of other things, but I had seen that my brother, my cousin, my father, my uncle had all enjoyed their time, and were, in the case of my brother, still enjoying it. And in the absence of a stronger calling, I thought, well, at least go in the army and see how I like it. I joined for 3 years, and I ended up doing 42, lack of imagination, but mainly because I loved it, actually. I loved the soldiers, their humour, the gratification of leading people who trusted you, and that the reverse relationship. You know, my father said, if you love your soldiers, there's nothing they won't do for you. And he meant it in the proper sense. I found that to be absolutely true. And they have to trust you, as you're saying, that your judgment is right. And as I got more senior, they like to be associated with someone who seems to be lucky. It was Napoleon, wasn't it, who said, I'd rather have a lucky general than a skilled general. And I know what he meant, and probably there's something in that. I certainly fall into that category. I was very lucky a lot of the time.
Well, you make your luck, surely. I mean, that's one of the... I mean, both of us probably, similar and different reasons, are quite lucky to be alive, but equally you do make your luck. I mean, if we look at this doing the right thing, when we met in Sierra Leone, you were a brigadier, which is what the Americans call a one-star general, but it's not a high office. You're on the up, but it's not, you haven't got the ear of the prime minister as a brigadier. And yet, you sent troops ashore in Freetown, in West Africa, in this nation that was being destroyed by civil war, with the rebels were in the town, as I was, cutting people's hands off just a few hundred yards from where I was staying. You sent troops ashore and then made the argument for a military intervention to put an end to that chaos. Can you just describe how on earth you managed to push that through, and why?
It was a sense of right and wrong. We had set ourselves up under Tony Blair, and I was in principle supportive of it, to do the right thing in the world. You know, you remember the ethical foreign policy and all that. If ever there was a case for doing the right thing, it was in Sierra Leone, where a bunch of, you know, I wouldn't even describe them as rebels. They were thugs, murderous thugs, that were exploiting the country's raw materials and the people mercilessly, as you said. You know, I remember, in fact, because you're slightly conflating 2 years. That happened over, I went when we first met in 99, in January 99, and then went back in April 2000 to sort of be like finish it off. But when we were there in 99, the rebels had been through their own, calling them the rebels, RUF, had been as far as the military hospital in the hills above Freetown. And I went to visit it at the request in part of Peter Penfold, who was the High Commissioner, but he'd had to flee to Guinea-Conakry. And I'd gone via Conakry because I arrived in Sierra Leone on a frigate because you couldn't fly in. It was too dangerous. So I had to get there by ship. I don't know how you got in, by the way. But anyway, probably before that point, but good for you. I went ashore in a rubber dinghy with a small party of Royal Marines. And after a couple of days of advising and assessing what was happening on behalf of the government of Sierra Leone, President Cabba, who was also in Conakry, by the way. Anyway, I went to the hospital. And a couple of families came to see me, and my soldiers, my Marines sort of looked at me, and one, I remember, was a young man, he couldn't be much more than about 18, 19, 20, and he looked at me and he went like that, he sort of nodded, and drew my attention towards the family that were coming up to me. And a little girl wanted to hold my hand, and then she realised, as I realised, she didn't have any hands because they'd been chopped off. And I was disgusted and appalled. I said to myself and those soldiers, you know, if we've got to do something about this, and you know, at the time there was not much we could do, but I did arrange for some help to go in. But when I went back in 2000, and my orders were simply to evacuate entitled persons, as it's known in the trade, and to leave Sierra Leone, I said to myself, I'm not going to do that. If I possibly can, I've got to do more. And my military judgment and instinct was that I would be able to do more. So I was sent, dispatched over a weekend, which was Sleepy Hollow in the MOD and in Whitehall at the time. And I set things in motion that turned out to be the operation that we're discussing. But I hadn't got any orders. And so I came under a lot of pressure, and people wanted to, as I think I've told you before, one said, if you're not careful, you're going to be chopped off at the knees. Watch out. That was a friend who was caught up in it, who tried to warn me. But I sensed that if I, and you made the point, I didn't have a relationship, understandably, with the Prime Minister, that if I had been able to talk to Tony Blair, he probably would have endorsed what I was doing. And anyway, I didn't care. I was going to do it because although I was sensibly ambitious, I had a higher calling for those few weeks, and my little team, who were marvellous, a chap called Neil Salisbury and Mark Mangum, who were my chief of staff. I said, "What do you think?" And they said, "You haven't got any orders to do this, Brigadier." I said, "No, but I can't. We can't just leave and let the RUF rampage through." And Neil had been with me the year before and see the sort of things that you actually saw too, Sam. And I remember Neil saying, "You haven't got any orders, Brigadier, but we're with you." And that's one reason I stayed in the army. The people like that who were so loyal, were determined to do the right thing. And there's a lot of them, believe me.
That's a pretty high risk play. To basically invade a country without the sanction of your own country with military force. You talk there about a higher calling. Was that a kind of a straightforward ethical issue? Is there a religious aspect to this?
No, not religious, although I count myself as a Christian. I'm not much of a churchgoer. No, I think it's what I like to think that most people in my position would have done the same thing. I don't know if that's true or not, but, you know, I'm sure there are plenty of other people in the army who would have aspired to do it. I mean, I've always been a little bit of a risk taker. And in a way, I think that's why, having got away with it more times than I should have done, why I continued to sort of prosper as I got more senior. Because I was also a lucky officer, lucky general, because I seemed to get away with it. I think it was an ethical thing. It was a very human emotion. I was actually ordered there with quite a lot of resources in order to do the evacuation. So I didn't actually invade in the sense that you suggest. I was sent there to do one thing, and I turned it into another. And funnily enough, the tactics that I employed and were necessary to protect the a sort of line around through which the people we were evacuating would have to come were remarkably similar to what I did for a different purpose, which is to get at the RUF and push them back in order to free up the United Nations, who were not excelling and were sort of paralyzed by the whole situation, to allow them to get a grip of themselves and start doing what they were meant to be doing, which is how we were able to get out after 6 weeks without a single casualty. So I think it was that motivated me, and a lot of instinct. You know, this isn't right. if I do that, we can actually stop it. And it was mixed with military judgment, born of many, many years of study of my profession. I made, you know, but we sort of made it slightly more scientific through Neil Salisbury, that I did an analysis that showed to my satisfaction that if we did what we ended up, we would probably succeed. Of course, there were risks, and if I'd lost a soldier doing it in that period when I had no orders still to do it, because it took about 10 days to get orders endorsing what I decided to do. And funny enough, I used the media a lot, in particular Alan Little of the BBC, who stayed out there and who reported very favourably and created the impression back in London that that we were central to what was happening, which was a stabilisation of things in Sierra Leone. And people back in London were saying, well, who's given you orders to do all that? And I remember, you know, Jeff Hoon was asked quite aggressively, and who was the Robin Cook and other, Peter Hain, had to answer quite serious suggestions in the House of Commons that I was stepping over a line, hadn't been given what was happening, and they sort of prevaricated in the way any politicians can, until Tony Blair at some point was persuaded, largely through the media, I have to say, because I had no direct link with him, and I was up against obstacles between me and that level, who didn't want me to succeed, and then suggested that someone more senior should come and take my place, and it was got beyond a mere brigadier. You know, professional envy comes into play a lot in any profession, including, sadly, in the army. But none of that succeeded, and after 6 weeks, having stabilised the situation, having watched the United Nations at last get off their backsides and start protecting the population and taking a side, which they hadn't realised peculiarly, that they were there to protect a democratically elected president. And I remember going to the UN civilian and military leaders and saying, why aren't you doing this? I mean, oh, we don't have a mandate. I said, yes, you do. You're not an interpositionary force. You have a mandate to look after the democratic...
Chapter 7 mandate.
Do you know, they didn't know they had a Chapter 7 mandate? I found it absolutely staggering. And yeah, I had to work with these people, so I bit my lip. But no, I mean, it was a wonderful thing to be part of and to be amongst a team that all identified with what we were trying to achieve, and were part of, you like, a little conspiracy for about 10 days that kept it secret from certain key people in London. And then Tony Blair, and that's why he gets, quite right, I think, gets some credit for this. I mean, sometimes he gets all the credit. Actually, as he'd be the first to admit, on reflection, he didn't know what we were doing for about 10 days, but then endorsed it, and we got on and succeeded.
So you bounced him using the media?
In a way, we did. And I think a common interest in doing the right thing. Because, funny enough, if you asked me what else I might have done, after about 5 years, I thought the army, you know, it was Cold War, we weren't doing much, and before the Falklands and so on. And I thought, well, I think I'd go and be a war reporter. But I'm glad I stayed in the army.
Yeah, you've got a much better pension and a lot more titles than I have.
Yeah.
Not very long after the success of a Sierra Leone intervention, Tony Blair was involved in, my words, cooking up the intelligence to prosecute an invasion of Iraq. Just explain to me at that time what you were doing and whether or not you were comfortable with what was going on.
Well, by then I was a major general, and I was something called the assistant chief of the general staff, working to Mike Walker to begin with, but for most of my time to a wonderful officer called Mike Jackson, who wasn't easy in the morning because he liked the evenings before and, you know, was a party.
You mean he was hungover?
Yeah, he's hungover. I learned not to go and see him before 10 or 11 in the morning if I could avoid it. Even then, there was an element to Mike that, you know, I would forgive him anything. But I got an earful once or twice if I got that wrong. But both he and I, and it was really him, were very suspicious of what you're talking about. And because what these political leaders and others don't realize is that, you know, we have our own intelligence and own judgment, born of much longer experience, understanding of war and all the things that go to make a war and the risks of war and the inevitable casualties that one should anticipate. So, fun enough, a lot of generals are the biggest peacenicks of all time, and I'm one of them, by the way. I would do anything to avoid war, particularly if it's unlikely to be successful. You know, the thought of large numbers of people dying in even for a good purpose, but knowing it's not going to work, seems to me the most stupid thing possible to do. Find a way around it. So we might come back to that. But yeah, I was as his assistant chief. I would represent Mike Jackson in about one in three or four chiefs of staff meetings, where the chief of defense staff, who was a wonderful admiral called Mike Boyce, would report back from his meetings with the cabinet and with the prime minister. And I was there actually representing the army on behalf of Mike when the dodgy dossier first came up. And I and others encouraged the chief of defense staff to query whether this was legal and what was the basis of this intelligence. I do remember one officer who I won't name saying, but was in on the intelligence side, saying, "Don't worry, we'll find something to put."
Don't worry, we'll find something
about that would justify what we were doing. And I went back to say to Mike Jackson, "This stinks." Because, you know, well, for all the implications that we can think of. And Mike Boyce, very nobly, because he was genuine, I don't use that word lightly, he was a very noble man, Mike Boyce. You'll know, then queried whether or not these orders were legal and wanted the Attorney General to satisfy him that they were. Easy thing to do, given the pressure that was on people. And the Attorney General, and I can't second guess his judgment, said, yes, it is. And we got on and did what we then did. But yeah, it was a very uneasy couple of weeks whilst we waited the answer. And of course, Mike Boyce had upset the establishment, and he was his tour as CDS was shortened to only 2 years before his successor came in prematurely.
So in short, you know, you must have seen a lot of the raw intelligence or whatever it's called, the intelligence product, the information, and you call it the dodgy dossier. And I hope I'm not speaking out of turn, but you and I spoke at the time and indicated that there were definite concerns over the veracity of what turned out to be a pack of lies. How does an establishment survive that?
Well, the British establishment is very under pressure, will unite, and can be very dangerous. And the instinct for most people is don't take on the establishment. I mean, if you upset them, and you're, as a journalist, an investigative type journalist, will know that. And indeed, I recommended you watch The Hack on ITV, which is on at the moment, which brings this out rather well, actually, how the establishment with Murdoch Press came together to resist what this chap was telling about the News of the World hacking scandal for months and months at vast expense. Now, whether it's true or not, I think an accurate portrayal of the risks one takes if you call out the establishment, whichever bit of it one's talking about. But don't take them on unless you're really prepared to have an uncomfortable life, because they may be right, by the way, Sam. They will think that their collective judgment and authority is more important than some of the unfortunate detail that might otherwise undermine it.
The unfortunate detail being in the Iraq War, yeah, that they lied about the intelligence. They straightforward lied. And my own investigations and others have established that without a shadow of a doubt. And yet we are in a position in which Tony Blair is being touted as a future governor for Gaza.
It is ironic. I think what one's got to remember, and I sort of count myself as a strategist and bemoan the fact that we are so short of statesmen and statecraft all around, particularly the Western world. And there are all sorts of reasons one could discuss that are very interesting about why that is so. I think social media and political pressures mean that being a strategically minded statesman is very difficult in this day and age. So politics and the requirements of the immediate issues on their plates often supplant long-term thinking. And it is interesting that the more autocratic leaders who have been in power or of influence and learning their trade for tens of years, if you look at people like President Putin and President Xi, they're brought up on this. And we have prime ministers and foreign secretaries who a few years before were attorney generals, and that's something quite big, quite good compared to most, or they were teachers, and however outstanding they were.
A lot of them are journalists, actually.
There are a lot of journalists, however good they are, they're not, on the whole, experienced in all these things, and they're very prone to instinct and influence of those who appear authoritative and knowledgeable. And I think in this case, Tony Blair, understandably, put, in his defense, obviously he could defend himself, but put the relationship with the United States as his top priority. And then, collectively, they engineered things to enable that to happen. And you'll remember that for a while he was, the toast of Washington and all that sort of thing. So I do understand why he did it, but I, without doubt, if you took that out of his record, actually, there's not much that went wrong, in my judgment, in his premiership.
Pretty big thing for it's to a very another big thing.
I bet you anything, Sam, he wishes it hadn't happened. I'm not certain what else would have happened. We presumably would have been like Vietnam. We wouldn't have been involved. But we would have lost a lot of credit and influence within the Beltway in particular. And that was a fact of the establishment as a whole, and those that were involved in the dossier obviously felt was a bigger issue than what I think in one or two genuinely thought that it was there, but they just hadn't found it. But yeah, the vast majority, those who were on the...
We
took, the UN inspectors were very good men. We'd all met them as they came through London they briefed us on what they were doing. They had no reason, and they were experts at finding things, as we've seen since in, say, Iran. People on the inside were saying, look, Saddam Hussein is talking this up because he needs to be seen to be big in the Middle East. He hasn't got this stuff. He might have had, but he got rid of it. Yeah. Rather like Gaddafi. And we accepted Gaddafi's claims. We still dumped on him, by the way.
Well, we'll come to that. We'll come to that because we're running out of time. We've got a lot of history to get through. I mean, one of the interesting things, there are many interesting things about you. One of the coincidentally interesting things is that you've gone from Cold War warrior through the humanitarian interventions, through Iraq and Afghanistan, and sort of have just, you hit retirement, but then came back as a field marshal during the Ukraine war. So you've gone from Cold War with Russia to what is now a warming war. But I want to get on to Afghanistan. So one of the interesting things, so Park, Iraq, I don't think we need to pick over what a catastrophe that was. And of course, you remained in the military through that period, serving your masters as you're democratically obliged to do. Then we have Afghanistan. It goes well, very successful. Special forces operations to depose the Taliban. I was at Tora Bora where the SAS and Delta and others were scampering around, almost catching bin Laden. It goes off the boil for a while. Iraq is then invaded as an extraordinary distraction, in my view. But you come back in 2006 in a role that I don't think has been performed by a British general since the Second World War, in command of American soldiers at war?
Well, at that level.
At that level,
We commanded brigade level.
You come back as commander of ISAF, as it was then called.
As we expanded round the whole of Afghanistan. While this was a Tony Blair, he agreed it with George Bush that they would focus on Iraq, and you're quite right about the distraction Iraq was, probably terminal distraction, actually. And Tony Blair at a NATO summit in Istanbul was persuaded, I don't think he had any hesitation, actually, that we would take on the leadership of Afghanistan through NATO, and they would focus on Iraq without getting out of Afghanistan. And little did I know that I was the man told to go and do it.
Having pissed off the establishment quite a bit by then.
I think they, despite Sierra Leone and my fight over cuts to defence, which has pissed off the Treasury and others, but they, if you like, they recognise, I'm only, you know, sort of imagining how it might have happened, they recognised that actually I had by then quite, probably unique at that stage, an operational record of success, and that if they needed this to work, they might as well give it to me if they didn't have another strong individual to do it. So I got the job. I was going to go to the command, the Allied Rapid Reaction Corps, anyway, I didn't know that. But almost as I arrived, we were told we were going to have to lead the NATO ramp up in Afghanistan.
You took over, and again, I happened to be there at the time, sometimes working alongside you where we made a film, but also under my own steam. And from the British perspective, from my analysis of it, and we discussed it at the time, it was a pretty much disaster. 2006 was a pretty much unmitigated disaster, which is an analysis I think you shared at the time, because you worked very hard to undo these Rorke's Drift type operations. And for listeners who don't remember it, there were pockets of, in forward operating bases, in at least three locations, of 70, 50, 80 men fighting under siege for months, frequently actually suffering from malnutrition. How on earth did that come about?
Well, don't forget, I was commanding the whole of the operation, so right across Afghanistan. What you're focusing on there is the British element of that operation, Helmand. While I took a particular interest, naturally, in what the British were doing, I had lots of other things going on at the same time, not least a successful operation led by the Canadians in Kandahar province. So there were lots of other things going on, and God bless the Canadians for leading that and defeating them, which, when you say that 2006 was a very bad year, which it was in some respects, actually, without what you're focused on in Helmand, it was a sort of draw score. Right. The Taliban were kicked out of much of Kandahar.
But did you run into institutional resistance to unwind it? Because it was you that basically said, in the case of a town, Musa Qala, where it was worse, you actually basically said, we need to negotiate a withdrawal, which is not quite a surrender, but it was a withdrawal.
And well, look, I mean, in the case of Helmand and the British, I made the point strongly, and funnily enough, it was sort of accepted rather reluctantly back here, because it was seen as a military failure of kinds. I don't know how, because I was very annoyed about it. I didn't take responsibility for what was happening in the south and east of the country till 31st of July. I remember it well.
Yeah, it was already underway. It was already a cock-up.
It had already started, and they hadn't told me, which they bloody well should have done, because they knew I was about to take responsibility for what they were doing. And I was very angry when I went down there and said, what the hell do you think you're doing, not at least informing us and getting my sanction for what you were doing. But the brigadier in charge had decided that he would accede to Karzai, but also really the governor of Helmand's request to go into these villages. And he'd put them, what they were known as platoon houses, what you've described earlier, which was a complete misnomer. They were little fortresses in the middle of hostile territory, a bit like sort of cowboy and Indian type stories. We lost a lot of very good people, which was central to my thinking, quite, I think, unnecessarily, although at that level, the strength, and you will have sensed this, of common purpose was humbling in the extreme. I mean, it was a British soldier at their best at that low level. But it was all forlorn. And I did say to the British, initially in Afghanistan, but then up the chain to London, I said, look, this is not sensible tactics. Furthermore, you haven't asked me. I'm having to carry the can politically, both in Afghanistan, but also what the Pakistanis were getting very worried. And I had quite a close relationship by then with President Musharraf. And I said, we need to negotiate. And soldiers, by the way, I think good soldiers, recognize when diplomacy, if you like, should take precedence over military action. Wars and fighting is fine if you're winning. Quite clearly, we were on the back foot, we were losing people, and we were not succeeding in achieving the political goal, which was to pacify those very tribal and traditional areas of Afghanistan. My concept was build up Lashkar Gah, make that into
the provincial capital.
But they, instead of doing that and letting that be seen as a beacon of hope and optimism by the local population, and then wanting more of that rather than what the Taliban were offering. So you worked over time to persuade people psychologically that what NATO and the government was offering was preferable. That went for nothing. They dispersed troops around, as you've said, these platoon houses, and we lost the initiative and never regained it.
Do you think, I mean, in a sense, I mean, at the end of your tour there as commander of NATO forces, did you know then, or did you sense then, that the whole Afghan adventure was essentially hopeless? I mean, the language had changed from we're going to shut down the ungoverned spaces which are exploited by terrorism to we're losing men to send women to school and various other nebulous democratic intents. Noble though they are, they're not worth sending young paratroopers to die over. When you got back, were you telling the system that it was daft?
Yes. I caveated it that if you had put in sufficient resources then and applied the right concepts, like the Afghan Development Zone concept, we had other things like the Policy Action Group, where for the first time, and it shouldn't have been me as a soldier up in Kabul to introduce these things, for the first time we had a mechanism to integrate Afghan and Western policy. Unbelievably, when I arrived, there was no such mechanism. And, you know, Karzai said, oh, yes, that's a good idea. Let's do that. And,
President of the country thanking a general for a civilian idea.
Absolutely.
Mad. What do you think the consequences of seeing the West essentially fail in Iraq and fail in Afghanistan have been for the rivals and enemies that we now face?
Well, I think huge, without doubt, and I see that you think the same. Just quickly going back to where it went wrong, because I think you put your finger on it, perhaps apparently inadvertently, but I know not, that it went from a counter-terror operation, which was broadly successful, to something very muddled and confused and well-intentioned but very poorly resourced, and the concepts underpinning it were hopeless. I remember being told that the police responsibility for the police was that of the Germans, and the Germans thought that it was all about traffic policing. They were going to have polizei at crossroads, and that would solve the hugely corrupt and inefficient police force. But I remember going back to Americans and commanding Americans at that level for the first time since the Second World War, which I hadn't really appreciate, but it was a great privilege to do this, and I'm very close this day to the American Army because they served me, even though they didn't always agree with me, they served me very loyally and very effectively at a certain level. The higher level they weren't quite so good on, but tactically you couldn't fault them. Before I was given command, I had to get Donald Rumsfeld's endorsement. And he came out to Kabul, and General Carl Eikenbry was my American counterpart, and the four of us sat in Eikenbry's office, and Donald Rumsfeld, after a few niceties, then got to the point, and he said, why is it deteriorating, General? And I said, with naively not remembering that he'd just slayed someone who dared to suggest that we were not resourcing the operation problem, I said, well, I think we all made very noble promises to the Afghans, but we're just not resourcing them, and they're beginning to suss us out, Mr. Secretary. And he looked at me without smiling, I don't agree, General, move on. So that was it. But funnily enough, I then got on rather well with him, but we went to see President Karzai. And generous at heart as the Americans are, they were all down one side. And Karzai put me down amongst his lot because he considered me his general, which I played up to some degree. And right in the middle of the conversation, Rumsfeld stopped saying whatever he was saying to Carter. He said, what do you think of General Richards, Mr. President? And I sort of, hang on, I'm here. Do you want this conversation private? And Mr. President Carter looked at me. Then he looked at Rumsfeld. I said, I like General Richards. And then getting into the swing of it, he said, what do you think of General Richards, Mr. Secretary? And Rumsfeld, I think, from my point of view, famously said, I like General Richards. He's only got one problem. He's a bit confused who's the 3-star and who's the 5-star.
But that has been a confusion you've always had.
Yeah, I mean, yes. Was the root of the problem. Initially, it was fine. It was an exemplary operation.
Yeah, but it went bad. But
it went bad, and it was ill-resourced, and it went fluffy.
But has it left us... us in the West.
Yes, very. I mean,
vulnerable.
There's no doubt. Yeah, I think we came out of it. I mean, the chaotic withdrawal, which was so ill thought through and unnecessary, by the way, our potential friends saw how we dumped on people. President Ghani is a bit of an acquired taste, but he'd been told all sorts of things, made all sorts of problems, and suddenly they dumped on him. And so, you know, people in the, in Africa generally and all around the world, they see these things. They wasn't only that we left breaking so many promises and expectations not met, and that is not clever.
Talking of broken promises, we promised to, among others, to protect the Ukraine from invasion by any other party. 2014, it was invaded. You were still in the office, I think.
No, you just left then.
So, I mean, I don't want to go over the history of Ukraine because I want to get up to the immediate analysis of what you think is going on now. But the West, as signatories to an agreement that said we would look after Ukraine and protect you in return for handing over your nuclear weapons, then refused, in the case of Britain, to even send lethal aid to help the Ukrainians fight the Russians out of their country. If you had been still in office, would you have been arguing for better and faster resourcing to Ukraine to see off the Russians?
I'm slightly contrary on Ukraine because, like you and so many of us, I mean, one bit of me is hugely supportive and gets angry at the way Ukraine has been let down. But I'm also very much a realist. I do not for one moment defend Russia, but I can explain it. I used to be the Soviet Army instructor at the Staff College, for example, and I've always had an interest in Russia, partly because much of my professional life, you know, they were the people I was prepared, having to be prepared to fight and probably die fighting. If I go back to my time as a young troop commander in Germany. So there's a lot in your question that doesn't excuse it, because I would have been pushing to honour our obligations. But I'm also a practical realist. And the problem is, and here we have politicians who don't understand war and all that is implied in going to war, because be under no illusion, that's what you've got to be prepared to do. And of course, as an aside, in a way, what we have done in the case of Ukraine is encourage Ukraine to fight, but not give them the means to win.
Well, it isn't that. That's not the same, though, surely, as saying they can't win. It is, given the right resources, they could win,
yes,
which is my view.
Yes, my view is that they would not win.
Couldn't win,
no.
Even with the right resources.
No.
Really?
No, they haven't got the manpower. Unless we were to go in with them, which we won't do, because Ukraine is not an existential issue for us. It clearly is for the Russians. By the way, you could say, don't be ridiculous, NATO's not a threat. That doesn't matter.
They're perceived to be a threat.
The Russians view it as a threat. And actually, the Americans, under the Monroe Doctrine, would never allow China to get a foothold in Mexico, for example. So there's a certain hypocrisy in the West stance on this. Russia sees NATO to its south, 500 kilometers south of Moscow. There's a huge wedge of NATO, which to them is enemy forces.
It's also, is it not, an example of, particularly in the case of Ukraine, successful, democratic, pro-European, Western nation with flat-screen TVs and Golf GTIs. And then the other side of the fence is little old ladies cooking and warming themselves on a single-bar heater. But I mean, I know that because I've seen it, literally.
Yes, I mean, but there are plenty of people in Ukraine who aren't as fortunate. So, but you're confusing values and interests here, which is a very...
Isn't Putin worried by Ukraine because... Yes, NATO potentially having troops or forces there is, and I've spent enough time in Moscow, you've studied it, we can agree that Putin sees it as a threat. But it's also a threat because of the cultural and political influence that it would exercise on his own authoritarian rule.
If it was a success.
So he has to mess it up.
But the issue is, do you go to war over that? And we've decided, because it's not an existential issue, we will not go to war. You can argue, and I absolutely accept that we're in some sort of hybrid war, but that's not the same as a shooting war in which our soldiers are dying in large numbers.
We don't have the resources
anyway. We don't have the resources, but it wouldn't make sense. Ukraine, despite our attraction for all they've achieved and our, I think, genuine, you know, affections for so many Ukrainians we've all met as a result of it, and you've been there, success there is arguably not, and I'm just still in this school, is not in our vital national interest. And you don't go to war unless your vital national interests are imperiled. And then you go to war to win.
Could we not give them the means to win? Is there not an establishment fear, unintended consequences of collapsing the Russian army in Ukraine? I personally believe that it is entirely possible to do that with relatively limited resources, I'm not a general, I don't have your experience, but I've knocked around a few years, and I think, and the Ukrainians clearly agree because they are working at the logistics nodes, they're working at the command and control structures, that the very demotivated Russian army can be folded up in Ukraine. It does, and that whatever the consequences might be inside Russia. Is there a fear of those consequences that has held Ukraine's so-called allies back? I mean, the help they've been given has just extended the bleeding time for the Ukrainians.
Well, that's my point. How much longer is this going on? And if you're right, it would be another year or two at best before the results you've just anticipated actually happened. How many more tens of thousands of people are going to lose limbs or die in that process with no guarantee of success? Because you're the Russians, as I understand, I watch this and follow various, the best intelligence one can get, I suppose you are too, which is, there's a lot on the net now. The Russians aren't losing. If anything, they're in a very traditional way, they are winning, inverted commas. They're slowly pushing the Ukrainians back.
Now, at
enormous loss, but they arguably, and this is where the physics of war is a factor in these things, that they can absorb them in a way the Ukrainians cannot. I mean, there's a lot of Ukrainians who don't want to fight, and I quite understand that, who have fled the country. The population of Ukraine is reduced by between 5 and 8 million, depending how you estimate it, since the war started, because people don't want to, you know, risk dying in a war, and I'm afraid that's the reality. So my instinct is that the best Ukraine can do is basically, and you already see President Zelensky, who's an inspirational leader, but he has to succeed now, or he's political toast. The best they can do is a sort of draw score. And it was General Milley, who was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, who said, and I agreed with him, but he had got a lot of headlines, who said in 2023, now is the time to negotiate. Because he described it as the high watermark of their attempts. And remember, people were even talking about getting back Crimea. I thought it was very ill-judged comments, by the way, by generals amongst others, because I never saw the Russians actually conceding Ukraine without upping the ante considerably. And we've got to be careful of talking ourselves into
nuclear. A nuclear war.
But be under no illusions, things are very unstable at the moment in that part of the world. In Europe, you can see that beginning of this testing of NATO airspace and so on. you don't go into these things without being alert to the risk, or you shouldn't. And that is a risk, because this is an existential issue for Russia. Despite, I mean, I agreeing with all the reasons why, good or understandable or bad.
But it's still existential for Putin. If he fails in Ukraine, he could be toppled.
And I think for more Russians than we might count now, because they are an old-fashioned, rather patriotic, and they only get certain sources of information too. It's an existential issue for Ukraine, quite clearly. But it's not an existential issue for Europe or clearly for America. I don't think it's going to be. I mean, the hypocrisy of European nations buying Russian gas and oil and doing what they're doing on the other hand.
You know, they're actually spending more on Russian gas and oil than they are on helping Ukraine.
Right. I rest my case. So, you know, this is when people like Boris Johnson, probably for good intent, encouraged them to go on fighting, but failed to give them the means to win, and talked about regaining all that territory. I said, as a soldier, they're not going to do that way back. And why Milley said what he did say. The other point is, even if you did kick them out of Ukraine, they're not defeated in the sense that we've gone into Moscow and they're all sitting there sort of with our arms up in the air. They're not. They're going to become very, very embittered and dangerous. And we need to think the implications of that through as well. So, like Zelensky, who would appear, and many others, including President Trump, I would now seek a ceasefire, but some sort of peace, and play a long game to get those oblasts and Crimea back. Might take two or three generations, post-Putin probably, but you know, you have to hold your nose, and we need to bring diplomacy back into this thing. I would start to bring Russia slowly but surely back into the Western fold in the way that, to be fair, they wanted back in the 90s, but we sort of failed to take them up on their requests, and then separate China from Russia, because perversely at the moment, from a grand strategic point of view, we're pushing these potential adversaries, you could say they are adversaries, together, which is exactly what we shouldn't be doing.
Because China is supporting Russia.
Yes, and China's a bigger long-term genuine issue than Russia is. And the other thing that disappoints me, we've also somehow alienated India in the process, so they're in the mix, and much of the rest of the world, because partly, as you were saying, about our failures in places like Afghanistan and Iraq and our inability to live up to our promises, they're not actually on our side. The rules-based order seems to look after those who dreamt them up back in the 1940s, not very good for much of the rest of the world. So if you look at a map of the world, a large chunk of it, the majority, but the biggest populations and the biggest land masses are not on our side. So grand strategy, that isn't very sensible either. And we need to start correcting it over a generation or two.
Do you agree with the recent British government assessment that China's not a threat?
I think China is a threat, but I know why they would not describe it as an enemy. China's a competitor. I don't think that I'm a great believer in Sun Tzu, and I'm sure President Xi and all the other Chinese top officials were brought up on Sun Tzu's philosophies. I don't think that they aspire, even in the case of Taiwan, unless Taiwan becomes very awkward for them, to militarily aggrandize themselves. They've got the One Belt Road Initiative, which I wish we had an equivalent to, because that's a genuine grand strategy, just like Sun Tzu would endorse. And they're making huge headway all around the world. I'll give you one example, going back to Afghanistan. Because of our refusal to engage with the Taliban, Russia and China are in there exploiting all their very considerable raw materials and rare earths, and we're stiff-arming them. All on the whole about the Taliban's failure to properly educate girls above a certain age. Well, you've got to play that long. This is where interests and values must be aligned, at least better than we seem to be in large parts of the world. And that's just one of many examples we could talk about.
But at the end of the day,
I did say I was slightly contrary on a few things.
Well, yeah, no, because there's an internal interest and values. Your values have often trumped what were perceived in the early stages of your career to be British interests.
But I synthesized them. in the field. It's great having values if your interests can be aligned with them and you can succeed. But when you're not succeeding, I mean, you have to judge what success is. But I would say in Ukraine, I don't think we're currently succeeding. Lots of wonderful people are dying, 90,000 plus amputees in Ukraine. I mean, is it worth it for this possible defeat, define it, no one has, of Russia in those four oblasts in Crimea? It might
be. But the Ukrainians, to be fair, the Ukrainians, they know what victory looks like. The West and allies keep moving the Overton window of that.
Yes, I think fewer and fewer Ukrainians want this war to go on. And President Zelensky himself has said he's prepared to do a deal. Mm-hmm. He just wants to be on the right terms. My sadness about Ukraine is I don't think either side will have irreconcilable positions at the moment, and that will be fought out on the battlefield. More people will die. And I don't think it's right for the West to say, this is up to the Ukrainians. We're there for as long as you want, say, people like Boris Johnson and Keir Starmer. Actually, that's, in my judgment, abrogation of their responsibilities, because we are all being affected by this, both economically, obviously, but also through our failure to succeed, which is gnawing away at people. And obviously, there is a risk that things can escalate, not necessarily into nuclear war, but we're beginning to see an escalation, which arguably is unnecessary to risk.
It's also open-ended, isn't it?
Where's it finished?
You mentioned Milley there, a distinguished general, also former commander of ISAF after you. I met him out there. He still thinks I'm a British spy.
Aren't you?
But he's also in hiding from his own president, having had his security detail removed, and even though he's had Biden give him a preemptive pardon. I mean, this is a man, former Special Forces commander, who has served his country and is now in hiding effectively from his own government. Are we now looking at this whole spectacle through the wrong end of the lens? I mean, how much more disruption and more erosion of democracy can America go through before it starts to appear to be less of an ally and more of a problem?
Well, you're getting into very sensitive territory here, and I am.
That's right. You're retired. You can speak freely.
I'm a crossbencher, I absolutely understand why you've asked that question. I mean, on a personal level, I think it's tragic that General Milley's in this situation. He had the integrity and honesty to say what he did say, and it conflicts with President Trump's own view of life. So I hope very much that President Trump and his advisors and the new Secretary of War, which says a bit in itself, will do the right thing by General Milley very soon. It's very interesting, that recent gathering at Quantico.
I was just thinking, how would you have reacted to being told you're a bit chubby?
Well, exactly. Luckily, I'm not. I'd be out of a job. But it was noticeable that I'm told that they did not get one single round of applause. I don't know if that's true or not, but I certainly, they just sat very stony-faced, very distinguished-looking bunch. But the fact that they have signed an oath to the Constitution and not to the President, I think, is really important and reassuring. That quietly, that was told, someone made sure that the media were very strongly alerted to that. And I think I have a huge regard, like you do, for many of those people. But going back to Milley and your the fundamental question. The thing with President Trump is that he's full of contradictions. I mean, what he's doing in Gaza, if it comes off, despite I think, collective distaste, and you could put it much more strongly, for Israeli tactics, will be quite an achievement. And if he could do it, and I think there's a long way to go on this yet, then, I find it extremely distasteful that, you know, he openly touts his candidacy for a Nobel Peace Prize. I mean, you know, you've got to have a problem to do that without, you know, seriously, I should get the Nobel Peace Prize. But quite bizarre. But that is the man. And the fact is, he is president. So I think that if he pulls that off and can bring Prime Minister Netanyahu with him, which he will find very difficult, then that will be quite an achievement. So you have that on the one hand versus that sort of stuff we've just been talking about on
the
other.
Well, threatening to invade Denmark and Canada.
I mean, crazy stuff, and Greenland. I agree. There's fundamental questions that come out of it. One of them is, of course, the fact that Europe has been living off American largesse for 50 ever since.
But that's
the
been grotesque, to, yes. In my view.
Absolutely.
To sponging off the American taxpayer has always been
absolutely
unconscionable.
Exactly, unforgivable. And we're now having our bluff call. But even if, say, we wanted to do much more for Ukraine, we can't do much more because we don't have the resources.
But isn't this a major, genuine turning point historically in that because we've got a mercurial, should we say, diplomatically, American president who is manifestly deranged in some of his policies, and he has forced NATO to look after its own house and pay for its own operations in the future, one hopes or assumes, that actually you could see the rise of the West coming out of Europe, a European hegemony starting to evolve independently entirely of America. And if so, is that a bad thing?
Well, I don't think it'll ever be entirely independent, not for a generation or two, because of the economic relationships as well as the enduring security ones. So that could happen, but it's not going to happen in a while, because it's going to take a long time to build Europe's defences and armed forces up to the sort of level where you might be able to say you're a competitor in some way. I hope never aggressively towards America. But I think, look, the world is so chaotic. There is a case, and I can see me being accused of peddling a sort of autocratic populist line, which I'm not, but there is a case in the way the Congress of Vienna in 1814 led to the rise of great powers and a peace that basically was sustained for 100 years. I think that we will find ourselves having to go back to that issue of values and interests, having to listen much more and respond to what is in our vital national interests rather than getting involved in the vital national interests of another power bloc or great power such as China or Russia. So if China decides to do something in its sphere of influence, and how you this will all be very untidy to begin with, but it might sort of shape out, we have to bite our lips and say, that's not for us. And that's really how the peace was preserved during that 100 years. And in a way, during the Cold War.
Yeah,
we didn't get involved with Prague.
Well, we did with lots of proxy wars. A lot of people died, but not our people.
Yes, Africa in particular.
South America.
But the Cuban Missile Crisis was resolved. The Berlin, a couple of Berlin episodes were resolved. They sort of did deals. There was an understanding on both sides. By the way, it wasn't just that we conceded to Russia at all necessarily. We did our bit. And I think that's how things will probably play out more. But there'll be a big pushback in liberal Europe against that. And that is where the next, electoral cycle is likely to take us. And you see Marine Le Pen in France now heading the polls here. We've got Nigel Farage, who I suspect his instinct is roughly in that area. And you've got Trump, who undoubtedly is thinking those sorts of things.
All three of those characters, and indeed the current British government, to a greater or lesser extent, talking about or have cut overseas development aid, which I know you see as an important strategic lever for the UK and its allies to pull. Why should people pay their tax pounds to underpin development or emergencies in corrupt nations of the global south?
Well, they're not all corrupt, so I think you might agree. Some are, but there's lots of corruption in other parts of the world too, different types maybe. So I think it should be viewed like we do our defence budget. This is a necessary thing to do to help secure Britain's future to mitigate problems early, to get in at the source of them. We're complaining all the time, understandably, about the huge increase in illegal immigration, but also other types of immigration. In part, that's because the countries from which those people are coming are very, very poor. Where's the grand strategy that builds their economies up, rather than putting billions and billions, trillions of money into armament spending? If you just put a small chunk of that into building the economies of the global south, you might find that suddenly the immigration problems start to reduce. I'm sure you would, actually, because they, in their own countries, they'd rather stay there. You know, if there's a future at the moment, it's the most resourceful often that make their way to Europe and Britain. So there is a very commonsensical reason for spending money on development in the round, I mean, for want of a better term. The other one is a moral issue, actually. You know, is it right that we, in a very, despite everyone's complaints, we're a very prosperous country, that we can't, you know, in the way we historically have given charity ourselves, that we can't as a nation help these people in such calamitous situations? I think most of us think we should. And 0.1% of gross national income being spent on that, I think, is both morally, but more importantly, from my point of view, in many respects, strategically an error, which will come back to bite us.
David Richards, I know you've got to go.